Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with the executive editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Gregory Kerfman, about the Supreme Court and Your Health, the upcoming oral arguments about Obama's Affordable Care Act at the Supreme Court.
So fascinating, and it'll be wonderful to talk with an expert who can translate this into what this really means for our health and our nation.
No matter what the decision is, absolutely. Mm-hmm. First, let's talk about some research that matters about smokeless tobacco use in troops that are deployed.
About alcoholism among surgeons and physicians.
Wow. About the patient-centered medical home and its implementation, perhaps in rural or less developed areas.
And about risky driving habits predicting teen crashes, car crashes.
Well, first, let's really jump right in there, not like paratrooping, but jumping right in about troops and their use of smokeless tobacco, which we've known for decades that troops are at higher risk of some of the tobacco use because of some of the marketing practices and the stress of deployment. And this is some research about smokeless tobacco use.
It is. It was reported in the journal Addiction, looking at more than 45,000 people who were followed from 2001 to 2006 who were sent to Iraq or Afghanistan, looking at whether or not they were deployed and their use of smokeless tobacco.
And 9% had been users of smokeless tobacco before they went to Iraq, but another 2% who weren't using it started using it. So, you know, that's close to 1,000 troops who were not using smokeless tobacco started using it. And we do know, Christy, that smokeless tobacco is very addictive, even in some cases more addictive than cigarettes.
Well, and deployment with combat exposure was linked to a higher risk of taking up smokeless tobacco than just being deployed alone. And so that suggests that the stress of that, and there's also a link that symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorders, those folks also had an increased risk of taking up these smoking and tobacco habits. So, I mean, it suggests that stress is playing a part in this decision-making process and certainly has risk to their health.
Right. Certainly, smokeless tobacco, with its risk of gum inflammation and tooth loss and cancers of the mouth, lips, tongue, these are real risk. And this may also be related to potentially some marketing practices that happen. We see it in this country. And so the bottom line of by the tobacco industry, by the bottom line is we should be asking those who come back about from the military about their use of smokeless tobacco. And if you have a loved one that's come back from the military that's using now smokeless tobacco, they may want to talk with their primary care provider about ways of getting off that addiction.
Completely agree. Speaking of addiction, we're going to talk about a study on alcoholism and its relationship to physicians. So the sad news is that about 15% of surgeons have alcohol abuse or dependency problems, and that rate is higher than people in the regular population.
Yeah, this was actually some research in the Archives of Surgery, Christy. And it's rare that I say wow as I'm looking over research, mm-hmm. but I said wow three times in this particular article. I said wow when I saw that particular research finding that you mentioned. I said wow when I found that these people who had the signs of alcoholism and were surgeons were almost 45% more likely to have a major mistake. And I said wow when I saw that the rate of this problem was twice as high among female surgeons as among male surgeons.
What is that about? About 14% of male surgeons and 25% of female surgeons showed signs of alcohol problems in this study. And the link with burnout, the link with depression, and the link with medical errors in the past 3 months of the survey, or reported errors, to me, this is dramatic, concerning for colleagues, for patients.
Yeah, there were, you know, they tried to survey 25,000 people, surgeons, and 7,200 responded. So they had a very low response rate. And you could say, well, maybe all those who responded had no problems with alcohol, so therefore the rates are much less. But you could also say those who didn't respond were more likely to use alcohol, and that's why they didn't respond. So it could even be worse. So we don't really know, but this is a significant issue. And I think there's some real implications here that I might talk about with my patients, both forcing a surgeon, maybe even other doctors, to be alert for that signs of substance abuse aren't limited to non-doctors.
Right. And if we actually, doctors are at very high risk of these types of problems, and we need to change culture. I mean, this clearly needs further investigation. And if this is the case, we need to be taking care of our colleagues and protecting patients and doing what we need to do to change the medical culture to make to keep our patients safe.
Certainly. And it's probably not unwise to, again, stimulate these conversations. If this is happening, we need to talk about it. And maybe we can have some interventions to help those doctors, just like we help patients who are addicted to substances like alcohol, because they're probably good doctors, but they're probably having a problem that needs a medical attention.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the next study. And this is about the patient-centered medical home, or you hear us talk about PCMH, which is a reorganization of primary care to focus on the cornerstones of what we believe in: patient-centeredness, comprehensive care, coordinating care, having good access for patients that's continuously improved through mechanisms to improve our practice and take care of our population.
Sign me up, Christy. I like that.
Well, you work in one.
I know, and I want to get care in these kind of practices, too. This was research in the Annals of Family Medicine, and it summarizes work that was done by a federal agency called the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality to look at how these types of great innovations in primary care and delivery of comprehensive care can be best implemented in smaller primary care practices that do take care of patients with very complex needs. We know it can be done maybe in these larger academic medical centers, but how can we move this into the rural parts of the country and those smaller practices that maybe don't have such great resources?
So we're talking about adding in care coordinators and support for practices to look at the outcomes, the data of their patients and how well they're doing, about quality improvement activities and teaching physicians, and then also being able to reimburse for it. There are a lot of challenges and a lot of aspects that go into this complex care, and yet we believe it's the right thing to do.
And what they found here is the two most important supports that these practices need in order to have this type of practice fully implemented is practice reimbursement for the time they do spend coordinating care. When you call up and you want your prescriptions electronically sent over, or your refills, or your answers, or your things set up to coordinate this care, and then the integration of this care coordination among the entire primary care team so that everyone knows about it, these require further work.
I know there's a lot of challenge in North Carolina to spread this across practices, and I'm looking forward to us having some expert guests on our show to talk about this. But I've also heard that in North Carolina, according to the North Carolina Academy, we are actually one of the leaders in the nation in terms of a state that has the most success with spreading PCMH in our practices.
Primary care medical home. Let's ask our great friends and supporters at the Health Sciences Library to have some good links, that we'll put up some good links on our research and our blog about the primary care medical home and ways that people can learn more about this issue.
I think that's a great idea. Let's do our last research that matters, and this is about driving and teenagers.
Well, Christy, I don't know anything about this. Having had two teenagers, driver and a daughter now who has a learner's permit. And I really like this research because the thought, when all of our listeners out there who've had teenagers and you who have smaller children, but they will be teenagers before you know it, this is the greatest concern that perhaps we almost have as parents, and this research addresses it.
It does. It looks at drivers who drive in a jerky way. So perhaps
not jerky like we don't like you.
Not like being mean, but drive in a way where they start too fast and then have to brake really fast. So that sort of start, stop, start, stop.
Were you in the car with me and my daughter recently?
Is that self-remote? familiar.
And the question is that sort of driving pattern potentially predictive later on about crashes? And so this research in the American Journal of Epidemiology examined this.
And they found that in looking at newly licensed drivers, the number of sharp turns and screeching halts the teens made predicted their chance of having a car crash or a near car crash within the next few weeks.
Yes, they actually had 42 teen drivers that they followed for 18 months and 68,000 driving trips. I'm so sorry that whoever had to go with them, but they equipped them with these types of equipment that can monitor what they call the G-force events. And these G-force events, this sudden jerking, stopping, and going, increased in the increased risk of crashes and near crashes. So I think this is really important. It suggests we have ways to potentially prevent crashes by really talking with teens and monitoring these sorts of things that are G-force or sudden starting and stopping.
Well, and you wonder if that technology could be incorporated in getting one's driver's license and the testing for those things to perhaps help correct these behaviors before they get out on the road.
Right.
On
we'll
their
put
own.
Up a link about these electronic products that are available. They're right now expensive, $500 and a monthly service fee. But for some parents, this may be well worth to really cut down on the risk that your child will have a crash. Well, Christy, we've had a chance to talk about teen crashes and G-forces.
The patients that are in medical home, about alcoholism among surgeons,
and about smokeless tobacco use among our troops.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion. After the break, we'll be talking with Dr. Gregory Kerfman about the Supreme Court and your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I will be talking with executive editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Gregory Kerfman, about the Supreme Court and your health. Adam and I have been looking forward to this conversation, and we're glad to have you with us, Dr. Kerfman.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, Dr. Kerfman, let's just dive right in, which is, it's not every day that the executive editor of the world's most prestigious journal writes a health policy opinion piece, or not opinion, but analysis of an issue. What got you interested in writing an article for the New England Journal of Medicine about the Supreme Court review of healthcare reform law? Why did you want to do it?
Well, Adam, I think many people in the legal world think that this Supreme Court case will be the most important case of the last decade. Some even say that it'll be the most important case of the century because of the implications, first of all, for our healthcare system and the future directions of our healthcare system. But also, yes,
correct. No, carry on. I'm sorry.
No, just to complete the thought, there are also implications of this case that are fundamental to our Constitution and to constitutional law. So the implications are very wide and deep, and it's for that reason that I've taken a special interest in this case and have spent a lot of time studying it.
Well, we certainly want to explore further the implications and that fundamental aspect of change to our Constitution. But I wonder if we might start by bringing it down to plain language of what are these major pieces of the Affordable Care Act. It's confusing, I think, to our listeners and to us as we watch the news and read about this with so much inflammatory language. And I really appreciate the chance to talk with a physician who can explain this in plain language to our listeners.
Sure. Well, Christy, there are basically, you know, to bring it right down to the ground level, there are two features, two provisions in the healthcare reform law that is now passed into law that are being challenged as to their constitutionality. The first is the requirement in the law that all U.S. citizens carry health insurance or pay a financial penalty. This is something that has really never been done before, to basically set up a requirement or a mandate that private citizens go out and purchase a product from private companies.
Unless you have certain exemptions mainly tied to income, but this mandate would, in your article you indicate, increase the rolls of the insured by 16 million people.
By 16 million people, right, exactly.
So the mandate to purchase a private entity is part of this.
It's a very critical part of it, and many see it as sort of one of the critical elements of the law that makes a lot of the rest of the law hold together. So
okay.
The idea, if we're going to get everyone in the country covered with health insurance, that this mandate is needed to make that happen.
Okay, so we have this individual mandate with some possible exemptions, and there are ways of doing that, which we may or may not get into later, these exchanges to make healthcare supposedly more affordable. But what's this other major part of the Affordable Care Act?
The second major part that is being challenged in the Supreme Court case is the very significant expansion of Medicaid. Medicaid is the joint program between the federal government and the states to provide health coverage to people who are in financial need. And what the new health care reform law does is extend the eligibility for Medicaid coverage to an additional 16 million people over the next few years. And it basically sets out a requirement that states participate along with the federal government to make this happen. The constitutional challenge is that, are the states being coerced? Are the states being forced by the federal government to do something that they may not want to do? And so the issue of federalism comes up in this part of the challenge at the Supreme Court.
So thinking about, so this is tension over government and state, over government requiring people to purchase something that's a private entity. There are lots of different tensions that come up here. Let's talk about the implications of what's going to happen in the next few weeks in this discussion, and what are the implications of that?
Well, a lot of it does, as you say, Christy, have to do with the role of the federal government versus the role of the states in healthcare, and who is going to have the authority to make decisions about how to cover citizens. Is it going to be at the level of the federal government? Is it going to be at the level of the state governments? And so both the question regarding the mandate and the question regarding Medicaid have a lot to do with federalism. They have a lot to do with the 10th Amendment, which says that the federal government has very specific enumerated powers in the Constitution, and everything else is left to the states. And so the question for both the individual mandate and Medicaid is, should the states have this authority, or should the federal government have this authority?
Can you speak to a minute about the how those arguing in favor of this law, what is the basis under which they say this authority mandates? Because I think the most people, probably because they've heard enough of the Republican debates, they understand intuitively the federalism, and that argument is pretty well laid out there. But I don't think there's been much discussion about the argument for why this could be constitutional. Could you help us understand that?
Sure. In terms of the mandate to purchase health insurance, or the requirement to purchase health insurance, the federal government believes that it has the constitutional authority based on what is called the Commerce Clause. And the Commerce Clause is a very clear enumerated power in the Constitution that gives the federal government, the national government, the authority to regulate all things in interstate commerce. Now, health insurance is a big part of interstate commerce. A lot of the money involved in funding health care travels between the states in interstate commerce. So there's very little question that a lot of health care dollars flow in interstate commerce. And the federal government is saying that it has the authority to regulate those dollars, and that it gets the authority to develop this individual mandate from the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, Article 3.
And so then what would be, as you think about this discussion that will happen, what would be the effect? So if what will be the effect to the states and to the people if the interstate commerce, if that power to regulate is changed? Like, what is the, break it down for the individual state and that effect?
Well, the Commerce Clause has been used since the time of Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal to give the federal government almost unlimited authority and power to regulate a lot of different aspects of commerce, interstate commerce. And that Commerce Clause has been used very broadly and almost without limits to give the federal government broad regulatory authority over a whole lot of parts of American life.
But I guess the question here, and we're going to need to take a short break, but the question will be for the Supreme Court, how you balance that Commerce Clause versus this regulation of private entity and individual liberty and the mandate, is it outside Congress's power? We're going to come back and we're going to continue this conversation. We're talking with Dr. Gregory Kerfman about the Supreme Court and your health. We'll be right back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with the executive editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Gregory Kerfman, about the Supreme Court and your health. Talking about, Dr. Kerfman, as you indicated, this upcoming conversation and oral arguments in the Supreme Court about the Affordable Care Act. And right before we broke, we started talking about the issues that they're weighing about the federalism and the versus the power of Congress to regulate. And I guess one of the questions comes up is that you discuss is if the Supreme Court comes down, are they likely to come down in such a way that would make all of the law, both for the Medicaid as well as for the individual mandate, unconstitutional or constitutional, or might they break it out? How can they decide one way or the other?
Yeah, that's a great question, Adam. There are several possible outcomes of how the court may decide this. Of course, one, they could leave the entire Affordable Care Act intact and say that the whole thing is constitutional, and then basically nothing would change. The federal government would continue to try to implement it. The second thing they could do is strike the whole law down. Most commentators think that's highly unlikely to happen. It's not impossible, but ordinarily the court doesn't strike down large pieces of legislation like this. If they do strike something, they may strike parts of it. And so, for example, the court could strike the individual mandate and say that it is unconstitutional, but leave the rest of the law intact. This is the technical term here is severing, so that the individual mandate could be severed out, struck down, and the rest of the law could remain intact. They could do the same thing with the Medicaid expansion. They could sever that out and say that that's unconstitutional, but leave the rest of the law intact.
And so
most commentators think that that's unlikely. Most commentators think that they will leave Medicaid alone.
So it, in your opinion, the most likely scenario is that they either leave it intact or strike just the individual mandate piece of this?
That's right. You know, I think anyone who thinks they can predict what the court is going to do probably is naive.
I appreciate the humility.
I think most people who think about this think that either the court will leave everything intact or there's a very real possibility that they may strike the mandate alone and leave the rest of the law intact. And then the federal government and the administration will have to kind of figure out how to continue to implement the law without the mandate. That could be tricky.
We're talking with Dr. Gregory Kerfman, executive editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, about his article, The Supreme Court Review of the Healthcare Reform Law. And Dr. Kerfman, I guess we should ask the question that I'm sure a lot of people feel if they don't even state, which is, do they trust the Supreme Court in this politically charged environment where the outcome of their decision, if made before the election, could sway the election? They have to be aware of that, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think there's very little question that whatever the Supreme Court decides, it's going to have huge implications. And it's going to possibly have an impact on the presidential election, for sure. So there is a political dimension to this. The other thing that I think is important to keep in mind is that public opinion polls have consistently shown that the individual mandate is very unpopular among the citizens of our country. And so would that fact impact on the thinking of the justices? The justices do pay attention to public opinion. Now, obviously, they're going to make their judgments to the best possible way that they can based on the law. They're going to keep their eye on the law. But, for example, all we have to do is look to the decision in Bush versus Gore and see that, you know, politics do sometimes have an effect on how the court thinks and how they decide. So well, would that happen in this case?
Well, and I guess given the tilt of the Supreme Court, one might feel that they might come down on severing the individual mandate. And I guess one of the questions outside of how one feels about that, which, you know, one can feel differently, but what would be the impact of one major aspects of this legislation being overturned? What would the listener who is a purveyor of health care and their loved ones, what would it be their impact of that?
Well, I think that in terms of our health care system, it would send the message that the highest court in the land believes that there are limits to how much the federal government can do in regulating health care.
It wouldn't prevent them from having Congress from passing a single payer system, for instance. That would be not totally unrelated, correct, or not?
No, I think everyone feels that Congress has the authority to pass a single payer system. It's just not politically possible for that to happen.
Okay.
But Congress does clearly have the power to do that. The individual mandate is a little different. You know, it's basically setting up a requirement that everyone in the country, with, as you say, Adam, some exceptions based on financial need, but everyone in the country go out and buy a private product from private companies. And that has never been done at the federal level.
And so
at the state level, the states can require people to go out and buy car insurance. You know, every state does that. But that is based on the police power of individual states. And nobody ever questions that states have that power. But we're talking now about the federal government. And this has never happened before.
So individual states could still pass or proceed with a similar policy. This is a distinction between that being a federal rule.
That's right. Now, Massachusetts has passed an individual mandate, and it's the state where I live, and it's working very well for Massachusetts. But that's one state out of 50. What we're talking about here is making this a nationwide requirement.
And as you look forward, what would be the next steps if this piece of it is overturned? How will we move forward?
Well, I think that the administration will undoubtedly, through the Department of Health and Human Services, continue to try to implement as much of the law as possible. But there are two parts of the law in particular that are pretty closely attached to this mandate. One is the requirement that health insurance companies sell health insurance to everyone, irrespective of pre-existing medical conditions that they might have.
Mm-hmm.
And two is the so-called community rating, which means that health insurance companies are not going to be able to charge people more depending on their demographics. So the individual mandate was intended to try to make those two provisions in the law possible to happen by bringing everyone into the insurance pool. Without the mandate, it's not entirely clear that those two provisions are going to be very easily implemented.
Hmm.
So we're going to have to see about that.
You know, we're going to need to wrap up in a second, but I guess one final question for you, Dr. Kerfman, is you wrote this opinion editorial in the journal. What did you hope might come about from writing this, other than being on our show, which I don't think you knew about? But what did you kind of hope might come about? Because clearly it's not just about the Supreme Court arguments. I can't imagine, because that will be over and within a few months, and your article doesn't influence whether that outcome of that decision alone.
No, what we were trying to do in the article was basically provide a sort of a primer about this case for doctors who read the New England Journal of Medicine, and try to explain to them how the case was going to work, how the oral arguments would work, and what the implications are for doctors and for patients. That's really what we were trying to do.
Well, I think you succeeded on that, because you made it at the level that I can understand. which is important, because this has been a very complicated discussion, and I've rarely seen something condensed into three pages that lays it out so clearly. So thank you for doing that, and thank you for being our guest.
We will eagerly be anticipating what's going to happen. It's March 26th, 27th, and 28th, and look forward to whatever follow-up summary you'll have following those arguments and the decision.
Well, I'll be in the courtroom all 3 days. And
How'd you get a ticket?
Well, as a member of the press.
Very nice.
I've done this a number of times before at the Supreme Court. It's always fascinating. And I would highly recommend that you go there sometime if there's a case that you're interested in.
We appreciate maybe after all the elections and the decisions have been made, we'll have you back on the show to get your assessment of how that's played out.
That would be wonderful. I would look forward to that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kerfman, for being with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Gregory Kerfman about the Supreme Court and your health. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health for House Call segment of our show today. We're going to spend a few minutes in answering your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you want us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments and your questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Adam, we've got some good questions today about menstrual cramps and lifting after back pain.
About varicose veins or veins on the legs, and can you get them removed?
And about going to the emergency department and then discovering that perhaps you didn't need to be there, or from your perception, it wasn't as helpful.
Well, let's jump right in and listen to our very first house call.
I'm 31, and I have severe menstrual cramps. What is the best thing to take to prevent this from occurring?
The best thing to take to prevent from recurring. Well, to prevent them from occurring or treat them when they've occurred. Which do you think, Christy?
Well, I think there are a couple different approaches. At 31, you would imagine that you may want to have children in the future and you want to keep your options open in terms of those things, but that's a conversation to have as well.
Well,
I'm saying you could if you really want to prevent it. But most people have effect from taking anti-inflammatory medications before their period starts. So if you know this is going to happen every month and you can predict it, then to start taking some ibuprofen or Motrin or Aleve or something beforehand can be helpful.
And there's some data that actually you should take it at a more anti-inflammatory dose rather than just a pain dose. So you might get relief from 400 milligrams of Advil or ibuprofen, but 800 milligrams might actually provide you some better relief. So feel free, if we're talking with your doctor and you have no contraindications, that you could take, you know, 2 to 4 to try to give that some relief.
There's also a potential benefit from being on contraceptive pills or other hormone therapies that can decrease your bleeding and decrease menstrual cramps. And there are also other IUD and other devices that can help.
Intrauterine devices.
Exactly. That can help.
Talking about medical devices.
Pregnancy, I know.
Those are fairly safe, though.
Prevent pregnancy, but also reduce bleeding and sometimes can reduce cramps as well. So it's a complicated answer.
It is. And thank you for your question. And let's listen to our very next house call.
I hurt my back really bad several weeks ago, and my doctor said not to lift anything heavy. What exactly does that mean? I work in a hospital, and I routinely must lift very heavy items sometimes.
Oh, boy, I feel bad for you for lots of reasons. I can share your pain because I've had my back go out several times. It's no fun.
Well, and this is one of those areas as a physician, I wish I had wonderful evidence-based, you know, information to share with you to say, do not do this and do this in terms of lifting and going back to work afterwards. I think...
What's your advice? What kind of the specific advice that you give? Because I think the advice here, what I'm hearing is that don't lift anything heavy. And our listener here is appropriately saying, I'm not sure what that means. So how would you answer that specifically, Kristen?
Well, I usually help give some guidelines of what's going to happen over the next several weeks and how long your back's been hurting, what happened. There's so many factors here that are hard for me to say in this situation. But I talk about moving your body so you don't want to just lay up in bed, and then proper lifting. So there is an element of focusing on learning how to lift so that if you need to do that in the future, even after your back pain's gone, that's not going to then exacerbate that and make it worse.
I think those are really critically important comments. I might tell this patient or someone like this, you know, if you really hurt your back, don't lift more than 15 pounds, you know, for the next 4 to 6 weeks. Now, you know, that's a judgment call. And if you feel like you need to lift more and you feel like you could, you can choose to do that. On the other hand, we do know the more you lift until your back is ready and you've had some rehabilitation time, the more likely you're going to re-injure it. So it's a tough call. I think you may need to find out what you feel like you need and maybe work with a physical therapist or your primary care doctor.
Unfortunately, I have a lot of patients who say they're lifting their baby, and you can't say, please don't lift your baby.
Well, hopefully they have a partner.
Exactly, who can help them out.
On both sides there.
Okay, let's do our next house call question.
I have really bad veins on my legs that hurt and are quite ugly, too. Will my insurance pay to have them removed?
Ooh, ugly veins in your legs.
And ouch, I can imagine that it does hurt.
And my mom has suffered from varicose veins over the years and had a lot of pain and discomfort and waited what I've always thought was too long. And in this case, you're asking about insurance paying for them.
And the procedure would be not necessarily cosmetic, but it would be a surgical. It'd be those who do vein interventions, which are usually vascular surgeons, occasionally dermatologists or plastic surgeons.
Important to tease out with your insurance to be sure they would pay for it or to know what the cost would be. If this is totally cosmetic and it's just that it looks ugly, then most insurances would not pay for you to do that.
But if it's painful and disfiguring, by the pain and growing larger and opening up or bleeding, I mean, those sorts of things they would pay for. So I think it really depends on how you want to describe them. Probably shouldn't say they're quite ugly. Probably should just say they hurt.
Yes, and hopefully that's helpful to you, but I would explore it with your physician as well as the specific insurance carrier. Let's do the last one.
I cut my finger recently and went to the ER because it bled a great deal. However, the ER said I did not need stitches, and they sent me home with a bandage only. How do I know when I need to be seen and when I do not need to be seen? I would love to avoid the expense and the time in the emergency room.
Well, you know, it's thank you for sharing what seems like potentially a smaller issue. You might even want to, it's not trivial, but you might think, God, did I really need to go there? I didn't need stitches. And it's always easier in retrospect to say what you needed and didn't need.
Right. And this happens a lot in primary care. People come with a sore throat, and if they didn't need antibiotics, they think, oh, well, that was a waste because I didn't need it. But sometimes what you're doing is you're consulting a physician with the right level of treatment. And that advice is what you're paying for in reassurance, hopefully. I'm glad your finger's not as bad as
you thought. And one indicator of do you need stitches sometimes is if you hold pressure on it for 10 or 15 minutes with constant pressure, and then you take the bandage off, is it still bleeding briskly then? If it is, then it might need stitches. But sometimes people don't hold pressure for 10 or 15 minutes, maybe even with an ice bandage, to see whether or not it stops bleeding.
Well, that's all the questions we have time for today, but thank you for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us on our blog at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Get our app on your iPhone or
Android. Called Your Health, appropriately.
Appropriately.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Gregory Kerfman. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We look forward to talking with you next week. Take care.
Bye-bye. Okay, I'm doing a quick promo with Dr. Resnick's show. This is Dr. Adam Goldstein with Your Health Radio. Please join me and my co-host, Dr. Christy Page, as we sit down this week with Dr. Frederick Resnick from Harvard Medical School to talk about medical devices, safety, and risk. All this and much more this week on Your Health Radio.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.